Critical Theory in Context. This is the Center for Social Critique's Critical Theory podcast. I'm the host for today, Marvin Ester, and I have the pleasure of speaking to Peter E. Gordon, who's the Emable B. James Professor for History at Harvard University, as well as a member of Harvard's Department for Philosophy. I very much appreciate your time today, Peter.
Thank you, Marvin. It's great to be here.
So as someone working on the philosophy of Adorno myself, I've come across Peter's work multiple times, not only the 2016 monograph Adorno and Existence, but you've also written numerous articles about Adorno, ranging from his aesthetic theory to his political philosophy, including an introduction to the republication of the authoritarian personality in 2019, which to my knowledge was the first English edition of the work that also included Adorno's very illuminating self-critical remarks on the famous study. Today we are here to talk about your new book, which is called Precarious Happiness, or in German, Prekäres Glück. And in this book, you focus on the sources of normativity in Adorno's critical theory. But while reading it, I also had the feeling that it wouldn't be too much to say that this really feels like a comprehensive overall interpretation of Adorno's work, sort of finding out the essence or the kernel, maybe, if there's something like that, or at least the underlying ethical ferment in Adorno's thought as a whole. Before we dive into the nitty-gritty of Adorno's thought and all the intricate concepts that you delve into this book, I wanted to ask you what made you become so interested in Adorno as a philosopher, as a one of the big theorists of the 20th century, so to speak.
Yeah, thank you. Marvin, it's really a delight to talk with you about this. I should say that coming around to Adorno was a circuitous thing for me because I really started my career working on Heidegger. And although I would never have considered myself an orthodox Heideggerian, my work on him did adopt an approach of interpretive charity. I understood his political record, of course. And although it troubled me a great deal, it didn't prevent me from finding a great deal that was of interest in his work. And I wrote on Heidegger for really the first, say, 15 years of my professional life, and really wrote two books that were dedicated to Heidegger and numerous articles. But I did find myself growing increasingly frustrated, not really with his politics, which after all were quite familiar to me, and little about his politics ever could surprise me at this point, but more the philosophical, the animating philosophical themes of his work. And I was particularly troubled by impoverished understanding of society that runs through Heidegger's work. Now, I had studied in graduate school under Martin Jay, who's of course very well known as one of the major interpreters and historians of the Frankfurt School, and has also written, of course, on a great deal of other things. So working closely under Martin Jay's supervision, I also felt, you might say, a certain anxiety of influence that I couldn't write about the Frankfurt School, and especially about Adorno, when, after all, my own advisor, my own Dr. Vater, had spent so much of his time working on Adorno. So it took many years to come around to working about Adorno. And when I did, it felt like something of a heimkehr, of a homecoming. I had always sensed a kind of intuitive proximity to Adorno in my own admittedly far more crude, less sophisticated mode of thinking. But intuitively, I identified with much of what he said. The argumentation struck me as somehow expressing in far more careful and philosophical language some of my own intuitions. So the turn back to Adorno at a stage of greater intellectual maturity was for me a kind of return to a thinker with whom I felt greater sympathy, not least because of his emancipatory ideals, his commitments to the Enlightenment, to a certain, let's say, broadly stated idea of rationality. And I also found it very interesting that some of his criticism of Heidegger, and broadly speaking of existentialism or existential ontology, also resonated with insights that I had come to on my own. So Adorno and Existence, a book I wrote in 2016, served as a kind of bridge. And in that book, I looked at Adorno's, his critical readings of Heidegger, Husserl, and Kierkegaard, three philosophers whose works punctuated his life in interesting ways. And that book formed a kind of bridge for me from the universe of existential ontology into critical theory.
Yeah, and it seems to me, now that you mention Martin Jay, it seems to me like you're also somebody who's, let's say, sitting on a number of chairs when it comes to disciplinary work. You're a theorist of intellectual history. You're also a philosopher. You're very much engaged with the intellectual history of 20th century Europe, but you also delved into phenomenology and existentialism, especially in the Adorno and Existence book. What kind of disciplinary hat did you put on when writing this book, just to give us a preliminary understanding before we really delve into the ideas? What was the angle that you were coming at Adorno from in this book?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I did train both in history and philosophy. And interestingly, these are two disciplines that don't often sit well together because philosophy emphasizes, you might say, the internal validity of arguments, and history emphasizes the genesis of arguments. And there's always been a certain troubled dialectic, you could say, between genesis and validity. I would say that intellectual history for a long time provided me with the most comfortable intermediary space where I could pursue both historical questions and philosophical questions. And as you may know, in the United States, what we call continental philosophy or post-Kantian European philosophy has often suffered from a certain kind of marginalization within the philosophical disciplines. So when I went to graduate school and really wanted to work with Martin Jay above all else, I, in a way, decided that intellectual history would serve as the most natural home. I have to say that as my career has advanced, I've come to recognize that internal questions of philosophical validity, the character of philosophical argumentation itself, matters to me rather more than historicizing or contextualizing ideas. And in that respect, this book, A Precarious Happiness, represents perhaps, you could say, the final landing point of a methodological shift that has involved, in a way, writing myself out of the discipline of history and writing myself toward a much more philosophical kind of method.
Which has a beautiful semblance to Martin Jay's development in a certain sense as well, when I think about his very historically minded reconstruction of the early history of Frankfurt School in the dialectical fantasy, and then his more conceptual philosophical working on experience and so on later on.
Yeah, I think that's entirely true. Martin Jay, or Marty as our student, as we students call him, has always been had a methodologically ecumenical temperament, and he just brings to all of his work a certain genuine fascination for the ideas, for their contexts. But when, you know, for him, contextualization is not containment. Contextualization enhances understanding. It never limits understanding.
Getting to your book and the core ideas, getting into the field of Adorno, writing a book about Adorno in these days, immediately puts you into a field of a wide range of interpretations, of different kind of perceptions of what the essence of Adorno's work is, if there is such an essence, and what have you. There's a lot of discussion, a lot of ideas of how to interpret Adorno. And I think you did a great service with this book, starting from positioning yourself in this field. And you make it very clear, not only reconstructing Adorno, and then the reader can figure out where you would fall in that field on themselves. You give us an idea of what you're really up against, and you call this the negativist reading of Adorno. Can you give us an idea of what this negativist reading of Adorno is, and why you took such issue with it?
Yeah, well, it did emerge as a kind of frustration. As I read Adorno and read through all the different facets of his work, I was struck by the fact that what I was finding in Adorno seemed to be different from the dominant interpretation, at least the one that circulates in the Anglophone world and the one that has become associated with Adorno's image or his, let's say, his even his popular reputation. I mean, you can find in the United States coffee cups with images of Adorno with giving the world the thumbs down with a kind of scowling negative look on his face. People have tote bags that say, es gibt kein richtiges Leben im Falschen, there's no right living in the false. There's a kind of popular understanding of Adorno that circulates that has something to do with his rather dim view of the culture industry and so forth, which suggests that Adorno was a person who saw in the world nothing but unrelenting despair, that his view of the world, therefore, was that the world was wholly false, or as he put it, that it was a Verblendungszusammenhang, which is usually translated into English as a context of total delusion. That Adorno, in a way, sees our world as thoroughly false, false through and through. And this has given rise to what you could call the negativist interpretation, that Adorno can offer us nothing more than a portrait of our own fallen world. This makes Adorno, as I put out, as I state in the introduction, a kind of modern day Gnostic who sees that the world is wholly fallen, that the world is without any glimpse of redemption, that it offers us no image of the good, but only a conception of the bad. Now, of course, this interpretation of Adorno does have a great deal of merit, and one can understand how it's taken hold. It's not just an image that circulates in popular culture, as if the culture industry had its last revenge. It's an image that is grounded in some of Adorno's, let's say, most dramatic, perhaps exaggerated claims. Now, Adorno did once say famously that exaggeration is the only suitable medium for truth. But as I say in the book, in a somewhat sly way, that dictum itself is an exaggeration, because of course Adorno could quite frequently stand back and provide far more complex and nuanced, variegated interpretations of social reality and culture that did not damn it entirely or see it as a fallen world. Nonetheless, the interpretation has taken hold, and it began to take shape already at the time of Adorno's death. Some people felt that he saw the world as so fallen that he had, in a way, retreated into the artifacts of bourgeois high culture, that he had become a kind of aesthete, that he had lapsed into aestheticism because he could no longer see any hope for social theory or social transformation. And Jürgen Habermas's famous chapter on dialectic of enlightenment in the philosophical discourse of modernity is one of the sources of this basic view that Adorno, along with Horkheimer, developed a picture of modern society in which there is no way out, in which reason has degenerated entirely into instrumental reason, and there's no remaining possibility of social transformation. Now, as Habermas points out, it's difficult to articulate a rational critique of a wholly irrational world without falling into what Habermas famously called performative contradiction. That is, what resources do we have as rational beings if we're saying that reason itself has degenerated into nothing more than instrumental reason? One has to arrogate to oneself an extraordinary epistemic privilege in order to make that work. Otherwise, one's just contradicting oneself. I call this the challenge of self-reflexivity, which is to say that for any social theory that wants to give a comprehensive picture of what society is like, that picture of society needs to allow for the possibility of the emergence of the social theory itself. Mm. So any social theory needs to account for the conditions of its own possibility. Now, some social theorists don't offer comprehensive portraits of society, so they save themselves from the challenge of self-reflexivity, and that's entirely fine. Not all social theorists want to be theorists of the entirety of society. I think Adorno did have that comprehensive ambition, and in this respect, he needs to respond to the challenge of self-reflexivity. So for me, this raised the stakes of the interpretation that I have found dominant. It's not the only interpretation, but it's certainly dominant, especially in the Anglophone world, which is, as I say, the negativist interpretation, that Adorno doesn't think we have any epistemic grasp of the good, that we only have a sense of the world being wrong or bad or false. These terms cover a broad range so that one can use them interchangeably here. And this didn't square with my reading of Adorno. I think Adorno's view of modern society is far more conflicted than the negativist interpretation allows. So my book really began with a sense of frustration that what I was finding in Adorno's texts did not harmonize with the negativist interpretation, according to which we live in a wholly fallen world without any resources for its transformation.
Yeah, and in a sense, I understand this to be a critique of a identification or a unification of Adorno's position in a certain sense, where we should think of him as a more nuanced or ambivalent thinker. And it struck me that the term that you use for understanding this sort of method that comes out of this more ambiguous, ambivalent position that Adorno takes in your reading is the method of immanent critic, which has been a very prominent term to coin a certain kind of left Hegelian, Marxist sort of critique of, can be a critique of the social, can be a critique of social products like the work of art, can be a critique, a form of critique that can be applied to many different kind of objects. But it's a certain way of criticizing that is neither a view from, let's say, the God's eye view, the as Charles Taylor said, the view from nowhere, but it's also not fully immersed. Can you maybe elaborate a little more what you take immanent critique to be and why you think it's specifically applicable to what Adorno seems to have in mind when he's criticizing?
Yeah, so, I mean, as I understand it, immanent critique is a method developed most of all by Hegel and then given a materialist transformation by Marx. And although Adorno was not by any means an orthodox Marxist, he belongs in certain respects to neo-Marxist streams of thought that carried forward the practice of immanent critique, where that practice is understood as one that locates the resources for the transformation of current conditions within those very conditions. Now, looking back to Marx himself, I would say that we can see how Marx himself practiced immanent critique. And one example that I use in the book is the quite well-known one of Marx's inaugural address to the First International Workingmen's Association. And in that address, Marx praises the 10 hours bill, which is the famous bill limiting workers to 10 hours a day. And Marx praises that bill as the victory of the proletarian principle over the bourgeois principle. Now, this is very interesting. I mean, a typical view of Marx as a revolutionary is that he's wholly against reformism. Yeah. But in fact, what we find in this quite moving address is that Marx is willing to endorse what was, after all, a parliamentary bill as exemplifying the ambitions, or we could say the principles, of the working class that are emerging within bourgeois society, even while they contradict bourgeois society. Now, I take from that a more general lesson that I think Adorno exemplifies in his own work as well, which is that immanent critique can show us how a current set of social arrangements contains within itself contradictory impulses and moments of anticipation that point toward the overcoming of those current social arrangements. And I think that this is what Adorno's practice of immanent critique allows. Now, this is famously stated in Adorno's essay in Prisms on Cultural Criticism and Society, where he entertains the difference between transcendent critique and immanent critique, and more or less endorses immanent critique as the more dialectical method because it takes advantage of the resources that are available to us in our current social arrangements. After all, he says, where else could we possibly stand? We would have to occupy an Archimedes point if we were to believe in the possibility of transcendent social critique. That is, we would have to somehow stand outside of our own social order. But as social critics, we belong to the very order we criticize. And therefore, immanent critique for him seems to be the only viable way forward. But interestingly, like Marx again, Adorno thinks that the resources that are available to us as social beings are resources that anticipate the overcoming of our current world. And in that sense, we have what Jürgen Habermas has called immanent transcendence, which is to say, immanent sources of normativity that point toward the transcendence of our current world. Or as Yaxel Honneth puts it, there are resources that we have, moral and political principles that we have, or norms that are available to us, that exhibit a normative surplus. That is to say, they aren't wholly satisfied by present conditions. And to fully realize those normative claims or demands, we would have to engage in some fairly dramatic transformation of the world as we now see it. So for me, that's what immanent critique means. And it seems to me pretty evident that Adorno, in all of his work, say his cultural criticism and his more technical philosophical criticism in such works as Negative Dialectics, shows us how immanent critique should proceed.
Mm-hmm. It seems to linger on a certain kind of presupposition about the object that you're criticizing, that it actually has those means, that there is actually some sort of point to grasp or some potential or some moment of a movement or something like that. We can later talk about, when we get more into the realm of the aesthetic, what that means, for example, in terms of artworks, how they provide this kind of moment of immanent transcendence. But speaking about Marx, it seems natural to first think of society, as Marx was mostly talking about the bourgeois society, in a certain sense, having this sort of ferment or kernel to overcome itself. And it was the limitation, after all, of bourgeois freedom, the limited, the bornierte, how Marx calls it, the very non-fully encompassing idea of freedom that still had this kind of emancipatory kernel. When we talk about this kind of immanent critique with regard to the object of society, what do we presuppose about society? What is the assumption that's in the backdrop here?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think that the assumption has to be that society is not a unified domain. That is, it's not seamless or lacking in contradiction. It has to be understood as an object that is shot through with contradiction. Now, interestingly, in Adorno's lectures on sociology, he brings up two counterexamples, both of whom he rejects. He rejects Talcott Parsons, the American sociologist who's quite well known for his work transforming and popularizing Max Weber's sociology in the United States. And he thinks that Talcott Parsons develops a view of society which is harmonistic, Adorno says. harmonistic in the sense that it sees society as wholly workable, that all of its parts congeal, properly cohere, and so forth. And Adorno says this is obviously an ideological view. It's a wholly affirmative view, to use Adorno's language. Now, Adorno rejects that. Rather more interestingly, however, he also rejects the views of Vilfredo Pareto for having a view of society as one of thoroughgoing ideology or falsehood. And Adorno says, well, this can't be right either, because if society were a realm of seamless falsehood, then this would itself already abolish the distinction between true and false. And of course, it would once again raise the challenge of self-reflexivity. That is, how could a sociologist properly understand society if society, and therefore our own understanding, is wholly false? So it turns out that Parsons, with his harmonistic view, and Pareto, with his view of totalizing false ideology, end up being mirror images that you might say dialectically are the same, because they show society without contradiction. A properly immanent critique of society has to see the social object as shot through with contradiction. Society can't be seamless. It has to be a society with breaks or fissures, as Adorno famously says at the end of Minima Moralia in Zum Ende, that one has to look at the world with all of its Risse und Schrunde, its rifts and crevices. And immanent critique, in fact, is only possible if society has those rifts and crevices. And finally, they have to be not just internal contradictions, but internal contradictions that have an anticipatory character. That is, they aren't just moments that don't cohere. They're moments that, in their very contradiction, anticipate something better.
So when you're talking about this anticipatory character, you've chosen a topical way to get into Adorno's thinking that seems, especially to the negativist reading of Adorno, very counterintuitive in a sense. You talk about happiness of all things, and you talk about happiness, about the crucial normative resource that immanent critique has to start from when criticizing the society. There could be so many objections against the idea of happiness in the spirit of Adorno, but more in a broadly spirit, one could think it's such a fuzzy concept. It's, in a certain sense, it seems so subjective, what makes one happy. It also seems so, it seems to work with the idea of the Verblendungszusammenhang, in the sense that Adorno says, Fun ist ein Stahlbad, for example. We can think of a totally false society where all people have these kind of corrupted sorts of fun or something like that. But you have something more particular in mind when you talk about happiness. Can you maybe first give us an idea of what are we actually talking about when we talk about happiness? Maybe even with some examples of how Adorno describes this.
Well, okay, so one thing to note is that Adorno can be unlocked in many different ways. And there are many different, let's say, normatively freighted terms that are on hand that one could use in order to explain what it is that Adorno thinks is currently lacking in our social world, and what therefore animates his immanent critique and what it's oriented toward realizing. And there are terms like happiness, there are terms like utopia, there are terms like truth, or perhaps most famously, the right life, right? Yeah. These terms cover a broad semantic range. Choosing any one of them and trying to identify them as the core or center of Adorno's philosophy contradicts what he himself says in Minima Moralia, which is that in philosophical argument, all claims should lie equally close to the center. So one sets oneself up to fail already by identifying one term and claiming this is the magic key that will unlock all of Adorno's work. And I recognize this, but I was very struck by the fact that happiness understood in a sufficiently capacious sense seems to capture for Adorno the this worldly and materialist satisfaction of the human being that our current false society disallows. This is the sense in which I used the word happiness. Now, the word in German is Glück, but as I make clear in the introduction, I think that Adorno had something deeper and more structural in mind, which corresponds in many respects to eudaimonia, to the Greek conception of a kind of human flourishing, a happiness which necessarily requires social frameworks and institutions for human beings to flourish in the proper way. And it's that Neo-Aristotelian idea that I think Adorno inherited in a way from Hegel and Hegel's concept of what Fred Neuhauser calls social freedom. That is an idea of the fully flourishing human being whose needs and desires are fully satisfied only when the entire world is structured in such a way as to satisfy the needs of all. After all, I think what Adorno meant when he said, es gibt kein richtiges Leben im Falschen, there's no right living in the false, is that no single individual could possibly have the privilege, could possibly have the genuine fulfillment if others did not. And this is why Adorno liked the quote from Benjamin, as long as one beggar goes hungry, there will be mythos. Mm-hmm. So in this respect, the notion of happiness is supposed to be capacious. It's supposed to be broad. It's supposed to imply something about individual and social being. And it's also supposed to be this worldly and materialist. And let's say in a Marxist sense, it's supposed to imply the emancipation of the senses. Now, this doesn't mean that it's hedonic in the narrow sense, that human beings are simply supposed to, you know, luxuriate, say, in, you know, fine wine and fine food and fine artifacts of high culture. I mean, Adorno was a very sober sociological thinker as well, and his notion of happiness involves those kinds of provisos too. But I do think it's very important for him that there's a sensuous material quality to human life which cries out for satisfaction. And this furnishes for him an important, let's call it, norm or postulate that orients him in his criticism. Interestingly, when he tries to work out this idea in Negative Dialectics, he appeals to Kant's doctrine of the postulates. Mm-hmm. And he says that in Kant's philosophy, we see how the postulates orient us toward a highest good, an ultimate happiness that would be commensurate with our virtue. That idea of the summum bonum is something that Adorno, interestingly enough, wanted to retain, even for his own much more materialist philosophy. He really likes Kant's doctrine of the postulates in that way, and I think he wanted to incorporate them into his own practice of critique. So this is the concept of happiness that I think is important for him. It's an image of the highest good. It's a conception of the highest good that he believes we can't do without if social criticism is to be oriented in the right direction toward achieving what it is that society currently blocks.
Yeah, and it seems to me that then we have to account for the concept of happiness as having, let's say, two modes that we can think about it. We can think about the happiness in the very real sense as the real kind of experience of happiness that is always precarious. That's why you also have this in your title. It's not just happiness, it's precarious happiness. And then we have the emphatic notion of happiness. And you, in your text, you lay big emphasis on the emphatic quality of many of those key categories that make us understand what Adorno really normatively had in mind, so to speak, when he talks about mankind in the emphatic sense. Freedom is something in the emphatic sense. Also, there's truth that when he talks about truth, there's truth in the emphatic sense. And always this kind of addition of the emphatic shows that there's a certain kind of contradictoriness or tension. Or can you maybe talk a little about the emphatic nature of happiness and also the precarious nature of happiness as instantiated?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I found really puzzling at Adorno is this idea of the emphatic, emphatisch. He speaks of the emphatic concept of art, the emphatic concept of truth. And then in his lectures on his introduction to dialectics, when introducing Hegel, but then moving beyond Hegel and introducing some of his own principles for dialectical reasoning, he speaks of the emphatic concept of a human being. And it's these are fascinating pages where Adorno is trying to explain to his students how it could be the case that we have an idea in mind of what it would be like for a human being to be fully satisfied and for all of the potentialities of the human being to find their realization, even though no empirical human being perfectly instantiates that that concept. So he therefore distinguishes between the emphatic concept of the human being and the empirical individuals as they currently present themselves. And this, I would say, permits Adorno to, and I'll use the terms crudely, strongly distinguish between ought and is, the emphatic concept and how the world is currently arranged and what we currently are. So that gap, of course, is what gives us normative leverage. We need to be able to conceive of the realization of the human being when the human being currently doesn't seem to exhibit those satisfactions. So this is what the emphatic concept of the human being is. Now, interestingly, Adorno says this kind of full satisfaction, fulfillment, he sometimes calls it, contrasts markedly with the despair we currently feel when we look at the world. And interestingly, I think Adorno is committed to the view that there's a kind of implicit rationality to our affective response, which is to say, we experience despair when we look at the degraded, the calamitous condition of our current world. But why do we feel despair? We feel despair because the world is not living up to our own demands, our expectations of what it should be. So, there's a contrast then between despair and happiness. And there's a lovely phrase in Negative Dialectics where Adorno makes precisely this point. And it's a point that interestingly involves a rejoinder to Hegel. So we all know in the Rex Philosophie, in the preface, Hegel says that philosophy arrives always too late to change the world. And that there's no longer a gap between the is and the ought, and that philosophy merely has the task of painting the gray of the world in gray. Now, Adorno responds to that in Negative Dialectics, and what he says is, consciousness could not despair of what is gray if it did not harbor the concept of a different color whose scattered traces are not lacking in the negative whole. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated phrase, but basically what he's saying is, if we think that the world warrants our despair, this can only be because it's failing to satisfy some higher demand or expectation that we have for it. And that's the emphatic concept that the world currently fails. So in this respect, I want to say Adorno does look like he has in mind something like the postulate of the highest good. Mm-hmm. And that orients us in our critique, even while we look around us and we see that nothing in the world fully satisfies that emphatic concept. And to drive that point home further, this idea of precarity is something that I took, maybe I'll speak about it later. It's something I took from another quote by Adorno. But the basic thought at the core of this is, it must be the case that we have some evidence for what the world could be, even if that evidence is distorted by the conditions of its appearance. Which is to say, we do have some norms, and we even have some evidence of what it would be like for those norms to be fulfilled, but that evidence exhibits damage. That evidence is born out of our current world, and therefore it can't help but show up in a damaged condition. This is what I mean by partial and precarious instances of the good in the midst of the bad. In this respect, Adorno really does want to practice immanent critique and wants to be faithful to the principle of immanent critique, that the resources we have on hand in the current world are going to be tainted by the conditions of their appearance.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think the philosophical contestation that will probably come up with this regard is, if we think of the emphatic as an ideal that we are somewhat striving for, but we only have those empirical instances, it seems to put the contradiction as we usually talk about ideals. It's something that you can never really fulfill, that you still strive for, but you're always bound to imperfection in the attempts of fulfilling it. And yesterday, actually, we had a conversation at the Roter Salon where you were talking with Thomas Kurana, who's the professor for philosophical anthropology and philosophy of mind at the university here in Potsdam, and Rahel Yegi, who's the co-director of the Center for Social Critique and also professor of political philosophy here at Humboldt University. And that was one part of that, and I wanted to quickly, since we recorded the conversation, wanted to quickly play a snippet of it and talk to you about it again, because it's exactly about the question of how do we think the contradiction between the, so to say, the ideal and its imperfect empirical fulfillment.
But let me come at it from the other side and make the case of precariousness. So the way you were portraying it now, it's precarious because we only see it dimly. It's within the context of the negative experience or the negative state of affairs that we have. And so, but the vision of this unverstellte Menschheit will then be one that is somehow rid of the contradictions or free of the contradictions. That you also have this really, for me, fascinating, shocking passage by Adorno, where he says, well, the contradictions should go away. They should be absent in that state. I couldn't believe it. and now why couldn't I believe it? So in my sense is that the way in which Adorno describes experiences of happiness, he wants to be very subtle about it. So some kind of overconfidence of being happy or some happiness in the face of others or something like that, that would be the opposite of what he wants. True happiness needs to be precarious. There's a certain delicate balance to it in a certain sense. Even we could say that what's false about our society in many respects is it involves all these contradictions but denies them and covers them and obfuscates them and covers them over and doesn't let them, but there's no way for us to acknowledge them. And it seems to me that there's a certain kind of, there are certain existential contradictions, let's say, that will never go away but that constitute human life, and a state of happiness would be one in which we can be open to them, or in which they come to the right, in which they flourish, let's say.
So there are very different kind of ways that the notion of contradiction comes into the picture here. And it seems that on the one hand, we see a contradiction between the way the world is and the way the dim possibilities of really having fulfillment, having happiness in the world as it is, and the ideal. And we get some ideas from the instantiations in the world, but we have this maximalist vision that will say we have to transcend all of this. But I have the feeling where Thomas Kurana, as a Hegelian in a certain sense, wants to go to is the question, does this mean that we want to negate the whole idea of contradiction, that we want to get rid of all contradictions in a certain sense? And there are these puzzling I want to say, moments in Adorno's, in some of Adorno's expressions, for example, when he talks about the Abschaffung des Todes something like that. Yes. It really sounds like the end goal is to get rid of all contradictions in a certain sense. How do we think with Adorno about these contradictions? Are there constitutive contradictions where we would say, whatever social arrangement we will arrive at a certain point, there will be contradictions? Or do you understand Adorno as someone who's like, in the end, there should be somewhat of a nirvana?
Yeah. Nirvana. That's probably the least Adornian term imaginable. No, it's a great question. And Thomas put his finger on a really startling theme in the book, but I would say also in Adorno as well. Let me modify the terminology somewhat here. I would say that we shouldn't speak about ideals, but we should speak of postulates. And one of the characteristics of a Kantian postulate, of course, is that it can be wholly counterfactual in the sense that we don't have full evidence for it. We have certain intimations of it, but it can be largely counterfactual. Even though, as Kant will say in the Critique of Practical Reason, say freedom or the free will can have objective reality from the practical point of view. So I want to hang on to this language of postulates. It's important for me, if we go back to negative dialectics, where Adorno makes this very interesting remark about mortality and immortality in Kant. And he says, Kant, in a way, could not accept the fact of mortality. It was an offense to his conception of reason. Now, this is a striking passage, and it's even more striking that Adorno would endorse this and take it on board for his own philosophy, saying that the metaphysical ideas in Kant need to be retained, even though he says they need to migrate into the profane or metaphysics slips into material existence. Why is Adorno saying that? Well, to follow your own language, because I think he does have a maximalist norm of what it would be for human beings to find their fulfillment. It's really surprising, but it shouldn't surprise us entirely if we think about Adorno's critique of Heidegger. What he finds most offensive in Heidegger is Heidegger's attempt to turn the agonizing fact of human death and our Sein zum Tode into a philosophically instructive lesson. Adorno calls this hygienic. He thinks that Adorno thinks that Heidegger is willing to squeeze philosophical meaning out of the fact of human mortality. And Adorno finds this deeply offensive. He doesn't want to do this. His alternative, then, is to say that there's something about our despair over the fact of human mortality that points us toward a higher conception of human fulfillment. Now, to illustrate what that would look like in materialist terms, we could look at, for example, this marvelous lecture that he gave on culture und Kultur, right? Most people know this essay. Most people may not know that he delivered this essay, this lecture, 18 times. So it turns out he liked it a lot. Now, the lecture is quite interesting because Adorno speaks in that essay about concepts of human fulfillment. He refers to Romeo and Juliet, and he sees in the love between Romeo and Juliet an image of human fulfillment. But then, ironically, in a way that I think is rather puzzling for those of us who think of Adorno's disdain for American culture, he speaks about the happiness of an American child eating an ice cream cone. And he says that really is a piece of fulfilled utopia. It's a materialist image of complete human fulfillment that we do need to hold on to because it's a material, even if imperfect, instantiation of our idea of the emphatic human being, of the human being who finds complete happiness. Now, Adorno is not a kind of individualist hedonist, so he would never want to say that a child eating its ice cream cone is a sufficiently rich, sufficiently structured image for the happiness of humanity. But he wants to hold on to it as what you might call a phenomenological model of the kind of experiences that do lie somewhere in our lives as partial and imperfect evidence that our postulate of maximalist human fulfillment has some epistemic warrant.
Yeah, and I think just to circle back on what you were just saying about Adorno's criticism on Heidegger, I mean, what's the puzzling point, I have the feeling, that we get it with his criticism of Heidegger and then his own stipulation that it would be about the abolition of death. I always took his criticism of Heidegger to be a criticism of what he would take to be a maximalist vision of self-mastery in a certain sense. So to say that the Heideggerian ideal subject in a certain sense is even at ease with the idea of its own death. And even that is something that the subject can in a certain sense master, and therefore it is a perfect vision of self-mastery. And I have the feeling the whole conflictedness of Adorno comes through here. He's very critical of that notion, yet he doesn't want to completely let go and say this is just an Anke, as Freud would call it. This is just a necessity, which would be in a certain sense the same kind of hygienic way to think about it. He's a bit torn. He doesn't want it to have the self-mastery kind of idea that Heidegger would put on it, but at the same time he doesn't want to let go of this kind of emphatic moment of really striving for a maximalist vision, as you were saying.
Yeah, it's a lovely way to put it. And I do think that Adorno's critique of self-mastery is key here. You know, Adorno wanted to break through the power of the concept. And ironically, he charges Heidegger, following Gunther Anders, with a kind of crypto-idealism. Because Heidegger's Seinsverständnis, the understanding of being, is a kind of privileged understanding that belongs uniquely to the human manner of being. Dasein is gifted with the Seinsverständnis, or understanding of being, that it brings to all experience, and it's only therefore in virtue of the human being that the world is disclosed. Now, for Adorno, what this means is that Heidegger, notwithstanding all of his attempts to escape the realm of mere conceptuality, is still residing within an idealist framework where the subject, or let's say Dasein, is the condition for the world's appearance, which is to say that Heidegger is still operating with a kind of Kantian doctrine of transcendental conditions. By the way, I think that's a very good critique of Heidegger. Yeah. And this is something that goes way back in my own work to articles I'd written on about Heidegger as operating with a theory of transcendental conditions in his theory of being. But more generally, this seems to imply that the human subject is in a way the principle of coordination, the ground of intelligibility for everything there is. And this once again installs the human subject as master of the world. Yeah. Now, Adorno, I think, wants to dismantle that. Adorno really does want to break out of the magic circle of idealism and admit that the human being is not master of its own social and historical conditions, but should strive to temper that impulse to mastery, which we could call instrumental reason, and instead respond in an unguarded fashion to the object, or to what Adorno calls the non-identical. And that ethic of vulnerability, as I call it, is, I think, a key to Adorno's own ethical and political project and his own conception of what it would be to be the proper kind of human being, to be responsive to the suffering of others and to be responsive to the material qualities of the world and the aesthetic world included.
Yeah, and I think for those who are readers of Adorno, two ideas, very related ideas that come to mind immediately here is, on the one hand, when Adorno talks about the relation of subject and object, he, one of, I want to say, almost a categorical imperative for Adorno is the preponderance or the primacy of the object. That is a very important notion that does a lot of heavy lifting for him in very many different areas of his thinking. And the notion of mimesis or mimesis. And just because we wouldn't do Adorno any justice if we wouldn't have talked about aesthetics as well. Maybe you can tell us something about the subject-object relations in terms of the aesthetic, because after all, Adorno's work, if one looks at his collected writings, it's astonishing how much he wrote about music. Almost half of it, I would suppose. It's an amazing amount in any case. And what's the role of the aesthetic when it comes to the idea of happiness? And what's the role of this kind of specific subject-object relation that Adorno has in mind when we talk about the realm of the aesthetic?
Yeah, it's a great question. So as I see it, this ethics of vulnerability opens up the human being and encourages us to adopt a posture of responsiveness to the priority or the preponderance of the object, where the object is the material object, but also the other person. And Adorno's very worried about the fact that human beings might be losing this capacity to respond properly and in an open and unguarded fashion to the preponderance of the object or to the non-identical, and therefore to the suffering of other people. He warns a great deal of the withering of experience and what that might mean for really the survival of the species. I mean, I think he has in mind the idea that if we were to lose the capacity for experience altogether, we would, in a sense, in some very deep sense, no longer be human. Now, aesthetic experience in the broad sense is one component of that kind of responsiveness to the object. Adorno's very stringent requirements for aesthetic experience have something to do with his sense that full responsiveness to the specificity of an object rules out forms of aesthetic experience that are shaped by the commodity form. And of course, his critique of the culture industry is well known, even notorious. But I think what he wants most of all is that we retain the specificity of our experiences, that the objects to which we respond in the aesthetic domain, as in all other domains, have the kind of specific quality that resists the exchange principle. So this is something that shows up in his aesthetic theory and elsewhere in his philosophy too. And again, this responsiveness, another name for it is mimesis. Our mimetic capacity, he thinks, is just crucial to what he thinks we are as human beings. Now, he thinks that children exhibit this kind of mimetic responsiveness to objects when they play. He thinks that all of us as human beings, when we engage in, for example, the practice of gift exchange, exhibit a kind of mimetic responsiveness and anticipation of the happiness of others. So this is very important for him as well. And then when it comes to formally aesthetic experience, he thinks that that mimetic capacity survives not exclusively, but perhaps most of all in unique works of art that are charged, therefore, with what he calls a promesse du bonheur, a promise of happiness. One point that I wanted to make as forcefully as I could in the book is that we shouldn't think that Adorno had a special love of what we could call austere modernism for works of difficult modern art, or avant-garde art that in the new canon, say, from the Second Viennese School onward, that are challenging and difficult, but also as ugly as the world that created them. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, in his Königstein lectures at Darmstadt, he gave lectures on the criteria of the new music, where he warns against this reading. He says, look, mm-hmm. it's not that modernist music is merely a transcription of the atrocities of the world. On the contrary, he says, and this is where I got the title of my book, there is as much precarious happiness as despair in the new music. Mm-hmm. And this for me is yet another example of his sense that aesthetic artifacts, like society itself, mm-hmm. are shot through with contradiction and with an unresolved dialectic between happiness and despair.
And you, I think, very elegantly show this contradiction when you describe how the work of art is at the same time outside of this world, or it appears to be in a certain sense outside of the immanence of the world. At the same time, it's an expression and it's deeply immersed, and it has this very contradictory nature. And this is why immanent critique, for example, is also the method of critique for cultural criticism, for aesthetic criticism.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that has irked me for a long time is the popular misunderstanding of Adorno as an aesthete who somehow retreated into the realm of great works of bourgeois art and turned his back on social critique. On the contrary, Adorno thought that his aesthetic criticism is actually another version of social criticism, because he thought that artworks transcribe both our aspiration to happiness and our current suffering. He's very explicit about this. He doesn't think that art would in fact really exist or have its raison d'être if it didn't have that role of serving as a seismograph for our social problems. Now, it's a complicated view how he makes that work. You know, the interpretive desideratum in the aesthetic theory is that in the artwork, problems of society return as problems of form. So he has this very interesting emphasis on formalism and aesthetic formalism, and that you can get to a critique of society through an understanding of aesthetic form. That's rather controversial, and I know there are people who don't like Adorno's formalism for this reason, but he never tries to prize apart the aesthetic dimension from the social world out of which it emerges. On the contrary, I mean, you know, the autonomous work of art is only ever relatively autonomous. If it were fully autonomous, of course, it would once again plunge us into a kind of myth of false transcendence.
So in one sense, one could say for Adorno, the aesthetic is political. Mm-hmm. Aesthetics and politics lie closer than could be, for example, suggested by those who accused Adorno of a certain kind of political quietism or a depoliticized kind of late philosophy that he was engaging in when writing, for example, aesthetic theory. But there's a very interesting continuation of themes of his earlier sociological and even social psychological writings, like, for example, The Authoritarian Character, to aesthetic theory. And actually, what was always fascinating to me is the kind of responsiveness and vulnerability that we learn about in the aesthetic theory is somewhat of the counter image of the authoritarian personality. If you look at the catalog of criteria of the authoritarian personality, it's exactly the human being, the individual, that's non-responsive in a certain sense, and that blocks responsiveness and that has strong defense mechanisms against responsiveness. Can you maybe elucidate this context a little more?
Well, you said it very well yourself. I mean, you know, in the 1950 co-authored research study, The Authoritarian Personality, which is really makes for fascinating reading, it becomes clear by the end that the authoritarian personality is characterized by a certain hardness, a certain unresponsiveness to the world, or what Adorno calls the inability to have experience. Now, having experience means being responsive to the world around us and to others around us, as opposed to shutting down experience and absorbing instances of worldly difference only by subsuming them under general categories or stereotypes. This is one reason why the authoritarian personality is so prone to stereotype or stereotyped thinking, particularly about human categories, racial and ethno-religious groups, and so forth. A lot of the prejudicial characteristics of the authoritarian personality has to do with Adorno's idea that they're not capable of responding to the specificity or the individuality, the particularity of human beings, but instead categorize them. So this, Adorno's very concerned, as he was concerned really his whole life, about the withering of experience and how our inability to have experience might take over to such a degree that we would be hardened, shut down. You might say we would exhibit something like the aesthetic bourgeois self as described by Max Weber, who lives in a shell as hard as steel. This, for Adorno, would be the true authoritarian personality. And it's quite important that this, you know, this kind of character is not some kind of monster. Adorno was concerned that this was becoming the everyday self, the conventional self that was more and more common in the modern world. In this respect, this is why he really liked the sociology of David Riesman. He thought mm-hmm. that the self is described, yeah, in The Lonely Crowd, that the self described by David Riesman is becoming, if you like, a stereotyped self. It was Adorno's worry that therefore the authoritarian personality would become more and more commonplace because conventionalism itself is a sign of this inability to experience things in their specificity. Interestingly, this is a view that Adorno shared somewhat with Hannah Arendt. And there's one lovely remark where Adorno responds to Arendt's idea of the banality of evil. Adorno misdescribes it as the triviality of evil. And he says, well, I pretty much agree with this. Instead of speaking of the triviality of evil, I would rather speak of the evil of triviality. But I think what he means there is there's something already quite menacing about conventionalism. And he worried that the authoritarian personality was, in fact, becoming the conventional, typical person of the modern world.
Before we wrap it up and say somewhat of a final word on why Adorno today? Why could Adorno still be so relevant for us today? I think it wouldn't be somewhat of an Adornian-spirited reading of Adorno if it wouldn't be also a critical reading of sorts of Adorno. And just to quickly point at two elements, I think one of the fair criticisms we still have to contend today is that there is a certain ignorance towards some aspects of what you could say popular culture or something like that. Of course, while he didn't understand in his famous, infamous essay on jazz, while he didn't understand that jazz to be what we think of maybe if we think about jazz today, still we have to contend, for example, his ignorant regard to, for example, I'm just thinking that he's publishing his philosophy of music in, I think, 1960, 1959. And 1959 is also considered by many to be the greatest year of jazz in a certain sense. Ornette Coleman writes The Shape of Jazz to Come, Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. There's John Coltrane, A Love Supreme. It's all happening in one year and not a single word by Adorno on it, while he's writing about the emancipatory character of music. So there is a certain kind of ignorance that we have to grapple with when we want to think about Adorno in his time and context.
Yeah, no, I mean, this does need to be confronted. And some of the more critical remarks in my book have to do with what I believe to be a real lapse when it comes to his understanding of jazz. He seems to disallow for jazz the more dialectical understanding of cultural artifacts that he applies consistently everywhere else. And I think this is a real failing. I mean, he had his tastes, and he came from a very sheltered family with a mother and an aunt who were both had been professional musicians. and I grew up with very specific Central European musical tastes and a very prejudicial attitudes about the tradition of European art music that ruled out a great deal. The remarks he makes about Sibelius are really just as nasty as the remarks he makes about jazz. So he did have prejudices, limits, misunderstandings, and I would say that in his remarks on jazz, he fails to apply properly what would be the more self-contradictory, imminent, critical method that he brings to cultural artifacts elsewhere. I want to point out, however, that in that failing, in his remarks on jazz, he actually exemplifies the misunderstanding of Adorno that I call the negativist interpretation. Because according to the negativist interpretation, we have no resources on hand for showing us what, say, happiness would be, or no instances of the good in the midst of the bad. Well, that's exactly how Adorno views jazz. And I think it's clearly a misunderstanding of jazz, but by the same token, this general interpretation of Adorno is a misunderstanding. Now, I have to say, to broaden this to a more general question about Adorno, I think that his attempt to furnish phenomenological models of, say, human fulfillment or human happiness raises a puzzle, which is, how do we know that his descriptions are right? After all, couldn't he be wrong in his description of the happiness that we see when a child eats an ice cream cone? Couldn't he be wrong in his descriptions of children at play? Couldn't he be wrong in his description of gift exchange? And couldn't he be wrong, for example, when he says that Adorno's Spätstil, late style, furnishes us with instances of hope? How do we know that these phenomenological descriptions are accurate? After all, the problem of normativity doesn't go away when we turn to description. Descriptions can either be correct descriptions, or they can fail to describe the object properly. And I think one of the deepest puzzles with Adorno is what authorizes his own interpretations of culture, society, and politics. It seems to be the case that Adorno just had a fair bit of, you could say, interpretive confidence that that his descriptions were accurate ones. And this raises the question, what if we disagree with him? I think he thought that if we simply responded to the object honestly and reckoned with its character, that we would find his own interpretations to be authoritative for us. This is, however, I think a difficult matter in Adorno. And I think we need to take seriously a remark that he makes elsewhere, that even as we hold fast to the normative, we should also admit the fallibilism of our critique. And I would say that what redeems Adorno from the charge of being too authoritative in his descriptions is that appeal to fallibilism, which you might say is once again the ethic of vulnerability informing his own practice of social critique.
So what better way to end a wonderful conversation on Adorno than leaving it to the readers, both of Adorno's works, of course, but also of Precarious Happiness, the book of yours that just came out. Peter, thank you for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Marvin. This has been a pleasure.